with so many things. I love hearing the Ashford Life stories about Elaine and the things that are going on with our kids. And having said, was a great week for those of you who are part of it, and those of you who weren't, it was still a great week. This morning, picking up on our David series, those of you who've been around for the last few weeks, we've been looking at this epic story of this character David in the Bible. We've looked at some of his exploits, we've seen him in different scenarios and different settings. We've come to know David the shepherd, David the friend, David the leader, David the warrior, David the musician and the worshipper, all these characteristics and attributes. And he said, well, what would it be like, what would it look like for us to be like David in those ways? This week, the story is a little bit different. We look at a different side of David's character and say, maybe not so much. But before we get into that, let me ask you a question. How many people here this morning have ever made a mistake? I think I know the answer to that, but it's dangerous to assume anything, so let's just be careful. How many people, second question, how many people respond positively when someone points out that you've made a mistake? How many people respond positively in that area? Not quite so sure on that answer. I was thinking about this, I was contemplating, you know, as we get older, do we find that when people point out our mistakes that we very quickly respond positively with that sense of maturity, or as we get older, we become more stubborn and actually find it more difficult to take helpful feedback? You try and give an MP's reply, okay, that's running, that's a political, diplomatic kind of response. Well, I was thinking about myself, as I get older, am I becoming more stubborn, or am I becoming more teachable, more flexible? I'd like to think it was a more teachable and flexible version. My wife, Claire, many of you will know that she's not here this morning, otherwise we could ask for her input on this question, but we'll have to do that some other time. And so this morning, the final question, I guess, is how many people would enjoy one of our mistakes being published? Maybe to go around the world, maybe to go on the news, maybe to be seen and viewed by hundreds and thousands of millions of people. I guess probably most of us, the answer to that is not. But effectively that's what's happened for David, isn't it? This is the story of David's life. It's in the most famous book, it's the most popular book, the Bible, or the group of books, if you like. Gone around the world, and David's story ends up and being read and looked at by, you didn't have a choice, of course, but that's what we're doing this morning. And this morning, we're going to reflect on David. And those of you who think about other characters in the Bible will know there's a reoccurring theme that takes place, because David, like many characters, finds himself making mistakes. And this is what we're going to talk about, we're going to discuss that this morning. But many other Bible characters do as well. There's a reoccurring theme in the Bible that God seems to not have a problem with people who've made mistakes. He seems to welcome them. He seems to restore them. He seems to actually bring them back into his presence and a relationship with him. You know, in God there is forgiveness, there is restoration, and there is wholeness again. It's a reoccurring theme. It's a wonderful part of this story and other stories too. And this morning, the title of what I'm going to talk about is Men Behaving Badly. And it might be, you may have seen it on your information sheet, maybe it's a slightly cheeky, jokey kind of title, but of course what we're going to talk about is not trivial, it's not light-hearted. And this morning, before I say anything, what you really hear, but this morning is not us together passing any judgments or inviting us to judge one another. It's not about pointing any fingers. As I was preparing what I wanted to talk about this morning, I was very aware that actually there's none of us that are exempt from temptation, from facing challenges and struggles. And those of you, I love the fact that when we sing our songs, so many times they just feed straight into what we talk about. One of the lines in one of the songs was, in our weakness and temptation, we still believe. And that's the position that we're in this morning. And as we look at this topic in David's life, this chapter, I'm very aware that some of us in the room will be facing or have faced challenges that are relational, marital, faithfulness issues. And of course, this morning, we're not looking to add to anyone's pain. But also, we realise it's important not to avoid important topics just because they might be difficult. So we want to be a church, we want to see Ashland Church, and those of you here 2 weeks ago, we had a guest speaker, Joy Lundell, and she talked about how we as broken people are the best people to help broken people navigate the challenges that we face together. It's true, isn't it, that we all need God's grace and his help. And today I want to look at an old story to see how it applies to us today. And maybe we're going to ask some real, honest questions and say, what can we learn from David's life? So is that okay? That's what we're going to do. So we start this story. It starts in Jerusalem. And we see this right at the very start of the reading today. We have this part. It says, in the spring of the year when kings normally go out to war, David sent Joab and the Israelite army to fight the Ammonites. And the reason that the writer of this part of the story wants to make this clear is because actually he's saying that normally the kings would go out to war. In fact, it's important also that it was spring, because spring would follow the rainy season and there would be a very clear decision that they wouldn't go out to battle, kings wouldn't go out fighting in the rainy season. They would wait till the spring, the land had dried out and it was more suitable, and they would go back or go to start commencing battles. And actually, we understand that this is the first time mentioned in the Bible that the leader of the people of Israel wasn't on the battlefield. So it's actually very important. We learn that actually David was resting. And nothing wrong with rest. Rest is good. The problem is that David should have been with his troops. And he finds himself in the wrong place at the wrong time. And this is the starting point, really, for his wrongdoing, for the sin, which basically means falling short of God's best. And the first thing we can learn from this story is to make sure that we don't find ourselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. The importance of being in the right place at the right time, and I would say also with the right people. There's an old saying that says, the devil makes work for idle hands. It's not in the Bible, I think, but it's true, isn't it? And isolation from people is so dangerous. It's a good reason why it's so important that we as church find ourselves in a place where we can serve alongside the people of God. If we're serving with the people of God, we're serving, investing our passion, investing our energy, then the likelihood is that we're less likely to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So David gets up after his afternoon nap. Maybe it's something we can learn about David there. How many people enjoy an afternoon nap? Oh, quite a number. Excellent. Yes. David gets up from his afternoon nap. He looks about over the rooftops of the palace. He sees this beautiful lady taking a bath, and he says he likes what he sees. And of course, it leads to a chain of events that we just heard described for us. And we might say, well, actually, if you are trying to look back at this story, you might say, well, where did David make his mistake? Where was the thing where everything started to go wrong for David? And we might sort of, after discussing, we might say, well, actually, the problem started in the bedroom with David and Bathsheba. But I would say that actually David's problem started at this point. His eyes lingered, and then he just paused. So it didn't start in the bedroom, it started on the rooftop. Martin Luther says this: you can't stop a bird flying over your head, but you can stop it nesting in your hair. What David should have done, of course, was gone back inside, maybe take a cold shower, maybe do a 5-mile run. But he didn't do that. He paused. He lingered. And Jesus himself speaks into this exact issue in Matthew 5, the famous Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus said these words. He says, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Jesus is explaining, he's taking the law, which the people would have known, and taking it even a step further. And he said, it's not just about actions, it's about your thought life too. And this is what happened to David. Basically, he allowed the bird to make a nest, hadn't he? And the battle that we face is so often the battle that takes place in our minds. Think about this progression. Sow a wrong thought, reap a wrong word. Sow a wrong word, reap a wrong action. Sow a wrong action, reap a wrong character, so a wrong character reap a wrong destiny. The Bible talks about reaping and sowing. The obvious connection is agriculturally between what we reap is what we sow. But also makes this connection between the choices that we make, our behaviour, and the things that take place, the consequences. In my experience, one of the biggest challenges facing us as followers of Jesus today is the whole area of the battle in our minds. And the Apostle Paul talks about this when he's talking to the Corinthians. And some of you will know these words in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. He says, "For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with as Christians are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God." And this is the bit. "And we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ." The problem is, many of us have got a bit of a way to learn in terms of taking our thoughts captive. I don't know about you, but I've got all kinds of thoughts in my head, and they're going left, right, and centre, they're doing things, and sometimes I'm following my thoughts rather than taking captive and taking responsibility for the thoughts that I have. Anybody else? And most of us, and of course thought life is just a big deal, it's a big issue in lots of different ways, not just in this particular circumstance. The truth is most of us probably don't have rooftop temptation issues, if we can describe it as that. Most of us probably don't look out over our rooftops and see other people hanging out. Is that true? I was going to say, if you have, invite me around, but please don't invite me around, because I'm not interested in that. So maybe we don't have rooftop temptation issues, but I guess if we were to think of what the modern day equivalent of rooftop temptation, I guess we could come up with a number of different things. But one thing in particular, we don't talk about it a lot in church settings, but the whole issue of pornography. And the late David Wilkinson, a famous Christian speaker in the 20th century, said over 25 years ago, he was looking into the future and he was praying and he had his prophetic word that he gave. And he said that in the future, pornography would be beamed into our homes. And of course, at the time, it seemed like an odd concept. How could that be? People must have questioned, what do you mean? This was days before internet and smartphones and tablets and laptops. But of course, it proved to be totally right. And most of us have access to all these things, don't we? Tablets and smartphones. I was talking to someone in the church very recently about some of the shocking current habits of young people who have smartphones. And this whole thing of, some of you will have heard it, the whole thing of sexting, where people are sending photos and there's content and there's things available. And it's one of those things where some of us are just going to be incredibly shocked and we look at how far we've come from where we used to be. And of course, we want to need to pray for our young people because they find themselves in this environment on a daily basis. But the whole exploitation and the whole awareness of sex and sexuality, you don't have to look very far to find it. It's readily available. And the problem, of course, is it that it becomes, people find themselves getting hooked to become addicted, and we find that actually in so many different and unhealthy ways in our thought life. And I know there's people in the room who help people with those kind of things. If we want to be living spiritually healthy lives, then it means we've got to be so careful as to what we allow into our minds. We need to be careful what we watch, what we read, what we listen to, what we download, and what we reflect upon. I've said this before, but some of you will know that I was brought up and there was a filter in our house, and if there was a question as to determine whether we could watch something, or whether we'd read something, whether we'd listen to something, then we had to apply a certain criteria. It's out of Philippians chapter 4, and those of you who don't know, the young lady in the front here is my mother, so she's vouching for everything that I'm talking about in this moment. But we were told that the filter to determine whether something is suitable to watch comes from Philippians 4. And to fix your thoughts on what is true, honourable, right, pure, lovely, and admirable. I think about these things, that seems to be worthy of praise. So if it fitted in that criteria, then we were allowed to watch it. I'm sure sometimes some things slip through and we ended up watching some things which maybe didn't fit all of those criteria, and maybe some of you have done the same. And it's kind of a little bit of an aside, but I said that I think David's problem didn't start in the bedroom, didn't start in, maybe it was more likely to start on the rooftop. But to be honest, from my experience, maybe it didn't even start on the rooftop. Maybe it started before that. I don't think many people wake up one morning and say, you know what, today is the day I'm going to commit adultery. You know, not wake up and say, today is the day that I'm going to do this. So for many of us, there are thought processes which start way before, aren't they? And we don't know, of course, what David's thought process look like. Maybe you've been out on the rooftop a few times. Maybe you've seen caving people before. Maybe this wasn't the first time. Maybe you thought, well, look, I'm the king, I can do what I want. We don't know. But it's so important that we keep a check on our own thoughts. And keeping a check on our thoughts is practical in itself, and taking captive every thought is important. On the Freedom in Christ course, which we run very regularly as church, we do it often, it talks on the Freedom in Christ course. Those of you who have done it, if you haven't, we'll be running it again. It's a great course, over 13 weeks. There's a part of that in the middle that talks about temptation, and there's a great deal that talks about how we think in our thought life and thought patterns. One of the things that Steve Goss, the guy I know, does, at one point he's talking about temptation, and he talks about custard creams. And he says, you know, if you've got a problem overindulging with custard creams, don't find yourself walking down the biscuit aisle. And it's very obvious, but actually it makes the point very clear, doesn't it? But actually, it's so important that practically we do things and put things in place so that we keep ourselves safe. I've had conversations with people on a very practical basis. You know, people have come to me and they've said, Matt, I'm struggling with the whole area of temptation. Can you help me? I'd like you to ask me the question on a regular basis, how I'm doing with this particular issue. And so I've done that, and maybe other people in the room who do similar kind of things. But it's a very practical way of saying, if we are struggling with a certain issue, then practically, let's do something about it. Let's not find ourselves in the biscuit aisle. It means that we can have people alongside, and we can walk together, we can pray together, and we can stand together. And you know, it makes such a difference when things are out in the open, because when things are hidden, it's so much more difficult. One of the other things that I think is really important is that we don't kid ourselves that we are immune to this kind of thing. I used to think that I was immune. I thought, okay, I was brought up in a Christian family, strong faith and belief in the things of God. Didn't think that I would struggle with any of these kind of particular issues. And I remember, as I was planning what I was going to say this morning, just to be really honest with you, I remember at university, it was a time when I wasn't going out with Claire, ended up developing a friendship with a member of the opposite sex, and one of my other friends had said, oh, just watch her. And I'm like, fine, it's no problem. And then I just remember one night, they were just getting really freaked out at the point where I thought, golly, there's something that could happen here. And I literally just ran home. I don't know where I was. So I am not staying around here. We didn't have phones in those days, so I had very, very little or no contact after that point. But it really just caught me by surprise. And I realised that actually none of us are immune. So maybe this morning, some of us need to hear that. I think it's a really dangerous place if we think that we are immune to this kind of thing. The Bible says in 1 Corinthians, if you think you're standing firm, be careful, because you could fall. So our advice this morning, if you're struggling with something, if you've got a problem, then let's tell someone, let's be accountable, and if in doubt, run. And in the whole area of handling relationships, Paul Reed, a guy who some of you will know from things like the One Event, he leads a church, or he used to lead a church in Ireland, he gives some really wise advice. Because as I think about some of these things, of course, it opens up the question of how we relate and how we connect with people. Because these days, many of us have colleagues, the people that we work with, maybe people in church, in all kinds of different environments. And it's so important that we maintain good relationships. And he said, he's got some wise words on this. He said sometimes there's a friendship that's okay, but sometimes there's a chemistry, a type of a kind of a flirting, if you like, that is not okay. And he talks about guarding our relationships. And he said this, and I thought it was really interesting. These are the rules of a wise old man, right? So I'm thinking, okay, well, this must be healthy and helpful. He says, it's okay to compliment people. It's okay to say to people, hey, your hair looks good. Hey, look what you're wearing today. He said, it's not okay to come and stand a foot in front of someone to look into their eyes and say, golly, you look amazing today. He said, that's unhelpful. And he's wiser than me, so I'm sure he's right. And his rule, and I like this, he said this is the rule he applied to himself. He said he treats women the way that he would like other men to treat his daughters. Ah, that's fair. Because I know exactly how, I've got a list of rules about how I want men to treat Lauren, my daughter. And Lauren and I have been through them at length. We've got quite a process involved as to when, if there are going to be any men involved in our life, then we've got some clear understanding as to how that will work out with a series of steps that she needs to go through. But he said this, he said, I treat older women like ants, as in aunts, aunts, not ants, not stepping on them. Aunts, let's go with aunts, even though that's not my natural inclination. Let's not say aunts. treat older women like aunts, similar age women like sisters, and younger women like his own daughters. And some of these things are different for men and women, aren't they? We respond differently. Men are often very visual, and women see things differently in terms of how they respond to men. But some things are similar too. And just before we move off this, some of you will know a guy called Gerald Coates. I remember he's an older guy, a preacher. Was around when I was much younger. I remember him talking about this subject and saying that it was a decision that he'd made that he would never close the door of his office while his secretary was in talking to him. And it wasn't because he thought that it was a risk for himself, but it was partly that, but it was partly as well what it looked like and what it viewed for other people. And you might say, look, some of these things sound a bit over the top, Matt, but many of us will know some of the sad scenarios of what happens when things aren't in place, and when we don't take captain at every door, and when there are situations or things that actually get out of our control, and most of the time we don't see it because things happen gradually. We need to be careful. And even the whole topic of sex inside and outside of marriage. I think sometimes people start looking at this issue and they say, well, have we got a current or modern view? Are we up to date on what society thinks? It's important to be really clear for us as a church what we think of sex. Of course, sex is a gift from God to be enjoyed in the right context, and that context being a covenant, marriage, relationship. And the Apostle Paul makes it really clear when he's talking to the Corinthian church. You can look it up if you like in 1 Corinthians 6. Because basically the Corinthians had started believing that the physical body and the spiritual body were two separate entities. So they had this view that sex was just something that you did with your body, but just like food, it was pleasure for a moment, it gave fulfillment, and that was it. It was just like, it was literally just like food. But Paul says no. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. By his power God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he unites himself with a prostitute is one with her body? For it's said that two will become one flesh. And Paul's basically saying that you can't split up this thing of physical and spiritual. What actually happens, what actually takes place, because why it's so important, actually the whole act of sexual intercourse is more than just physical. Actually it's spiritual, it's emotional, it's the whole thing tied up in one, which is why, of course, when people are joining themselves to different people, that's why it becomes such a harmful thing for us. And again, this isn't about judging, this is about looking at saying, well, what does God's design, what does God's order in relationships. The second part, Paul goes on to explain, because all other sins a person commits are outside of the body, but whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you receive from God? You are not your own, you are born to the Christ, therefore honour God with your bodies. And I think our culture, like the Corinthian culture, cheapens and undervalues sex, whereas God places a much higher value on the importance of sex and relationship. Well, hopefully that's clear. So let's move on in the story. So David sins, Bathsheba is the starting point, she becomes pregnant, David tries to cover it up, he arranges for her husband to come back from the army, and he hopes that if this will all pan out, he's got this plan, and he'll sleep with his wife, and no one will find out what's happened with David, but of course that doesn't happen. David turns out that Uriah, the husband, says it's not honourable for him to do this, so David has to move to plan B. It escalates deception, and there's a cover-up. And of course, we see that what ends up happening is David ends up effectively plotting a plan to murder and to kill Uriah. The problem with adultery we see here is that it has many friends: lies, deception, greed, and selfishness. And we know from what it says in the Bible that God loved David and hated what he was doing. The great news is, in the nature of God, that he was so committed to David that he uncovered his sin. You know why? Because God wasn't finished with him. And that's the wonderful thing about the good news of grace and mercy that as Christians we preach. We get, don't we, what we don't deserve. And the psalm that David wrote after this incident, after the whole incident with Bathsheba, it just explains to us exactly where David was at. David writes this psalm, Psalm 51, it says, "Create in me a pure heart, create in me a clean heart," or pure heart, some translations say. "Against you, you only have I sinned, and done what is good in your sight, so that you are right. So you are right in your verdict, and justified when you judge." David's basically, he comes to the point and recognizes that he's made a mistake. And I look at in the passage that we read, David acknowledges it straight away. He doesn't find himself making lots of excuses. He doesn't come back to God and through the prophet Nathan, who has explained this metaphor and this story. He straight away puts his hands up and he says, "I recognize that I've made a mistake, that I've done that wrong." And you notice that actually when God comes, something very important, when God comes, he convicts David. And the great thing is that David recognizes his mistake so that he can move forward to a better place, to a place of forgiveness, to a place of freedom. What we often find, and you notice that the difference between knowing when God is speaking and convicting, or whether it's the enemy of God, the devil, because in those situations, we don't find that we're convicted, we find that we're condemned, which means that we feel shame, we feel we live in fear, and actually we feel tied up, we feel, and you can describe it as bondage, we feel like we are something that is not right, it's not at peace with us. And David recognizes that ultimately it's God he has sinned against, and he wants to bring right. And the great news is, for David, is that he finds forgiveness in God. And the great news is, for us of course, that we can find forgiveness in God too, today. It doesn't mean that there weren't consequences to David's actions. If you read on in the story, we're looking at 2 Samuel 11 and 12 today, but if you look further on in the story, you'll see that there were consequences to David's actions. And we'll think about that and look at this sometime next week when we do the final part. We think about the whole area of David's legacy. But it does mean that he receives forgiveness and is set free from the sin that he's committed. And of course, this is great news for David, but it's great news for us today that actually we still live in an era where there are mistakes that we make. We have to be really clear, don't we? If we're talking about sin in our lives, then let's not call it something else. That's what it is. It falls short of God's best for us. But we don't come this morning with a sense of this isn't judgment day. It will be a judgment day one day, but that's not today. Today is Mercy Day and it's Grace Day. And if you were here last week, I felt really strongly that we felt the same, that last Sunday was Affirmation Day, that we find ourselves hearing the words of affirmation from God. As David was speaking to us in the whole story of Mephibosheth and the kindness of the king, and the grace and the mercy of the king as well. And this morning, as we begin to close our time together, then I just want to say to us that today is Grace Day, today is Mercy Day. So this morning, as always, how do we respond to what God is saying to us? Well, maybe there are some very specific practical things this morning. Maybe you find yourself in a situation which is some kind of temptation. Maybe there are things that you've put in your thought process, maybe there are things that you've allowed to linger, which have become an issue for you. Maybe people who are struggling very specifically this whole relational, marital, faithfulness situation. And for some of us, of course, we feel the effects of broken relationships in our lives. Maybe today is about receiving forgiveness, and maybe today is also, for some of us, about giving forgiveness too. I've already said today is not about beating ourselves up, but maybe today is a warning for us. Maybe it's a reminder for us. But the important thing is that we don't get what we do deserve, and we do get what we don't deserve. And this whole thing of purity, well, is purity possible? Do we live in a society now which actually, this is a dated concept of purity? Well, I have to say that we have to believe that purity is possible. Let's be honest about the problems, let's talk about them, let's not have subjects and topics that are taboo. But the truth is that God is able to deliver us when we make right choices. The Bible says that God won't allow us to be tempted beyond what we can bear. God will always provide a way out for us. C.S. Lewis said that, "Be ye holy is a promise, not a command." God has provided a way to save you. I love that little quote. "Be ye holy is a promise, not a command." You know, we hear it, we think that there's a God wagging a finger saying, "You have got to be holy." But actually, C.S. Lewis is saying, "Be ye holy is a promise." He's saying that it's possible for you and I to live holy lives. God will never allow us to be tempted beyond what we can bear. So today, as we close our meeting, and I'll just pause in a moment for us to reflect and respond, can I encourage you that if you're married, and I realise that everyone is, can I encourage you to invest in your marriage? We run something called the marriage course, we'll run it again at some point, and a number of people have been in the room and been a part of this. If you want to find out some more, we'll gladly talk to you about it. But it's basically an opportunity for us to do a health check. It's basically for us to have a look and a think on what it looks like to be married and to invest in that. If you're single here today, then can I encourage you to develop healthy relationships? Well, that's true for all of us, but especially for young people who are navigating this whole area of relationships for the first time, we want to make sure that as a family, as a church, that we are able to support and encourage our young people as they make the choices that they do. And let's not struggle on our own. Let's allow God to shine His light into our lives. But recognize the difference between God's conviction and those things which might feel like condemnation that the enemy would love for us to hear. So today, they have grace and they have mercy. Just going to pause for a moment, please. allow us to respond and realise there are a number of things in our worship and stories and things that we've heard. Just invite you to just say very simply, God, what do you want me to take away this morning? What are the things that you're speaking into my life? How can I respond? Well, hopefully it's clear, but please, this morning the message is not one of beating up or judgment or a finger wagging. The message is of a God who is a God of grace, a God of mercy. And hopefully that's who we are too. People of grace, people of mercy.